God, the Author of All, Part 2, the seventh talk in a series entitled Biblical Philosophy, the Message and Worldview of the Bible, was presented by Jack Crabtree on January 15, 2012, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. The handout to which Dr. Crabtree refers in this talk is handout number 5 in this series.
So I want to finish up what we started last week. We're in a series called Biblical Philosophy, the Message and Worldview of the Bible, or Why Jesus Would Not Be a Christian. And I'm responding to an artificially constructed creed that I call the Ordinary Christian's Creed, and sort of taking it element by element, statement by statement, and critiquing it. The first statement involved the doctrine of the Trinity, and I responded to that, and I gave a critique of that. So that's left behind us. Last week we began looking at the nature of God and God's relationship as creator to the created order, to the creation. And what I proposed last week is, one way or the other, when we get to Genesis 1:1, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, we don't look at that in a vacuum. We have a set of philosophical assumptions. We have a picture, a model, an image, an idea, some kind of notion of what it means to create something that informs what we think it meant for God to create the cosmos, the created order. And I proposed, 3, 4? There may be others, and that part of your critique could be to propose an alternative, but God could create the universe the way a builder or an artisan builds an object, or a builder builds a house or something, takes existing materials and arranges it and structures it and orders it into something useful and meaningful. He could have built it that way, created that way, or he could create it the way a parent creates a child out of himself, so that the created order is a part of God himself. And although we typically associate that with Eastern religions, there are streams of Christianity that have something like that perspective. Or he could have created reality kind of like the way a wizard conjures up reality. He has the power, the art, the mastery of deeper magical principles that allow him to exploit those principles and bring into being something that did not be before. So he could conjure it up the way a wizard does. I rejected all of those in favor of the model that I think makes the most sense in the light of everything that the Bible says, is that he creates reality the way an author creates a literary work. My dad asked a question that I think is important, I need to address, because it probably was confusing last week. In Genesis 1:1, I wasn't intending to suggest when I said God is an author who in his mind is imagining reality. That doesn't mean that, the problem with that is Genesis 1:1 sounds like he's bringing something into actuality. He's not just imagining it in his mind, he's bringing it into reality. And that's true. That is what Genesis 1:1 is saying. So to make the model more complete, and our analogies are going to break down, as I think I suggested in the question-answer period last week. We are finite human authors. Our creative abilities are finite and limited to our experience. God is vastly bigger and transcends us in so many different ways. So the analogies are going to break down at crucial points. But imagine you're a novelist. But unlike the typical novelist, you can sit down in your study and literally think through from beginning to end in detail the whole novel that you're going to write. We can't do that, but it's not far-fetched to think that God could do that. God could conceive in advance a detailed account of all of cosmic history in advance. Genesis 1:1, then, is God sitting down at the desk, fingers to the keyboard, beginning to now objectify that which had been in his head. So you see what I'm saying? The creative act in Genesis 1:1 is the objectification of his plan or purpose for cosmic history. It's when cosmic history is going to be, as Hegel would put it, alienated, put outside of himself, not just no longer just in his head, but put in a form that exists outside of God's own being. Well, that's what Genesis 1:1 is describing. Creation becoming actual as something external to God. And that's what we call reality. That's what we call history, is when that unfolds. But as I think we see in John 1:1, what the biblical perspective is that God had conceived down to the very last detail every element of that history before it even began, before he began to externalize it and make it actual. So in John 1:1, where you have in the beginning was the Logos, and the Logos was with God, my contention is that what that word Logos there in that context means is in the beginning was the story. That is, in the beginning was the narrative. In the beginning was the script of cosmic history. That he was going to, once he got around to it, was going to objectify in an actual dynamic unfolding history throughout time as we experience it and as we know it. So that's what I'm proposing is the biblical model, not any of those others. And a second comment about last week, it's important that we not get hung up on I didn't spend most of my life thinking that God was a wizard. But that's exactly the model that I had for how God created the universe. If you'd asked me, well, was he acting like a wizard? I would have said no. But he was acting like God, I would have said. But the important thing is the concept, not the image, not the picture. And conceptually, what is it that I spent most of my life as a Christian believing? That God had the ability to simply make something that was not him out of nothing simply by speaking it into existence. But the critical thing, and this is where I part company now with Christianity, the critical thing is, what is it that he objectified out there? What is it that he gave existence to outside of himself? Something that he could interact with and live in and inhabit. It was his equal. It was from him, but it was his equal. And as I suggested last week, the critical thing to understand is the difference between the author model that I am proposing and any other model that you might use for understanding God's creative activity. The critical difference between them is whether or not the creation of God is equal in being to God himself. In the author model, the creation of God is God's inferior. Not just like him, but not as good. God actually transcends his creation. It's a whole different level of existence. As a whole different level of existence, it cannot impinge on God's existence. It has no effect on him. It has no feedback mechanism that plays back on God. It is completely and totally within his power to determine what it is if he wants to. And nothing in that created order has any power to have any effect on God whatsoever. That kind of asymmetry exists in the author model, but none of the other models. But I would argue that what's most typical in Christianity is to think of the created order as having some kind of relationship to God, where the created reality has some kind of feedback capability and can play back and affect God's being, his existence, his his experience, whatever. And we'll talk more about that as we go here. So I think I've addressed the questions that have come up. I want to go on to C on the outline, if you're working off of the outline, answering the objection that somebody might raise to what I'm suggesting here. One objection is, come on, Jack, Christians don't believe that. They don't believe that the created order exists right alongside God and is his equal in being. Well, they may not put it that way, but I would argue that anywhere you turn in interacting with Christians and they're thinking about this stuff, they show all kinds of evidence that that's exactly what they're thinking. So I would propose that there are many ways in which the way we reason and think about our faith is you'll find Christians talking about God in some sense or another being obligated by the created order. This thing that he's brought into existence is of such a nature that God has to do X. Or God can't do why. Why? Well, because reality that he created, he's answerable to it. He has to answer to it in a particular way. The typical Christian view of the atonement is founded on that view of God's relationship to his creation. God created this reality, and he structured the nature of justice in that reality in such a way that God couldn't find any other way to save mankind except to send his son to die on the cross. C.S. Lewis almost says as much in the analogy in the Narnia tales, the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Aslan is killed and brings about whatever transformation is in there. It's been a long time since I read it. But he brings about whatever he does because the White Witch knew the magic, but Aslan knew the deeper magic. So built into the fabric of the reality that he was a part of, there was this deeper magic that he knew how to use in order to bring about redemption. But notice that redemption is accomplished by working with what is, by working with what is given. And God Aslan himself was answerable to what has been given in the world that he inhabits. That's a typical Christian's concept of the atonement, I would argue. That God has to work with the history as it has been created and as it has been given. It has a moral fabric to it. Justice is built into it. Cosmic justice is of such a nature in the very fabric of the universe that God dare not give life to people in such a way that they violate cosmic justice. Now, I know your typical Christian believes that. I believed that for decades. I mean, I know that's true. That's how I thought about the atonement. That's how I understood the relationship of Jesus and his death to our salvation and so on. But notice the view of God that's ultimately back behind that. The view of God is that God is sitting here face to face with his creation, which is of such a nature, has the character that it does, and God dare not violate it. If he violate it, something bad's going to happen. But we're treating him like the creation and the creator as peers of one another. Or we often speak, Christians often speak, of God benefiting from one or other aspect of the created order. How many times do you go to a worship service and have the worship leader basically describe to you that God is here today to hear us worship him because somehow, in some way or another, he needs it? Or at least desires it or wants it, gets something out of it, right? Well, think in terms of an author in a novel creating a congregation to praise the author of the novel. I mean, am I looking forward to that? If I'm the author, if I'm the novelist, am I looking forward to chapter 5 because they praise me to high heaven? Well, I'm making them praise me to high heaven. How could I get anything out of that? Of course they're praising me to high heaven. I scripted it. But I'm not benefiting from it in any way that is not totally under my control whether I benefit or not. They're not giving me something that I couldn't have any way that I want to get it. And yet that's not the way we think. What we think is God put us here, created us here, put us here in the world because now we exist independently of him, autonomously, and perhaps we can do something for him or give him something or benefit him in some way that otherwise he'd be lacking, a deficit that would be there for in God. That makes sense if the creation is somehow the ontological equal to God. But it makes no sense if we're not. That way of thinking fails. If not worship, love. Why did God create human beings, we often hear? He just wanted some love, right? So he created us that we might freely love him. Why does he want us to freely love him? Because he has a deficit that could be filled by people like me loving him. Really? Am I going to get some need met as a novelist if I write a novel and have the character love me, the author? I don't think so. I don't think that makes any sense. I don't think it works that way. It's not about me having the beings, the characters, the realities, the elements of the created order feed me in some way. I'm doing the reality. They're not affecting me. I am expressing myself through them, but they're not giving anything back to me. I don't think that's the right way to view God either. God is not getting anything out of our existence. He doesn't need to get anything out of our existence. Or we hear Christians all the time talking about how important it is that we live lives of obedience, or that we evangelize, or that we pray, or that we do this or the other thing, because God needs our cooperation in order to accomplish his purposes in the world. Again, that makes sense. If God lives in this world like we do and has to deal with this big, huge, complex history, and that's a lot to handle, it's a big job, so eliciting our help through our cooperation would make a certain amount of sense. But if God is the complete, total author of all of reality, with everything completely and totally determined by him and everything completely under his control, does he need our cooperation? That makes no sense. Any more than the characters in a novel better cooperate with me, the novelist, because I don't know if I can get this done in time by the deadline if they don't cooperate, you know? That makes no sense. And yet, that's more like the relationship of God to us. Or the flip side of that is that God can be thwarted by something in the created order. We are constantly thinking that because we are human beings with free wills who make free choices, that maybe in our freedom we will actually hinder God or thwart God from doing something that he wants to do. And that's often the exhortation that comes from the pulpit. Don't be out there disobeying God. You're going to stop him from getting the good stuff done that he wants to get done. One way or another, that exhortation gets made. Or Satan. Satan's going to thwart God. And we better do our part to cooperate with God in defeating Satan, because we wouldn't want Satan to win. Some of you long-timers may remember, a long time ago on the radio program In Search of Truth, in the studio there was a guy that was debating me who honestly, I think, took all this to its logical conclusion and said on more than one occasion, it's so critical that we pursue holiness because Satan might win. And he was not blowing smoke. I mean, he was utterly sincere, biblically ill-informed, but logically impeccable. He was taking the Christian worldview as it exists in most Christians to its logical conclusion. And I think he was right in his worldview. Right in his assessment of the ramifications of that worldview. He just had the wrong worldview. he had a worldview that was not a biblical worldview. He had a Christian worldview instead. But if the world and everything in it is the equal to God, then maybe it will thwart God. And we talk that way, think that way all the time. Or that God could be limited by something in the created order. Our freedom by sin and suffering in the world. The most popular faddish theology today is open theism. Most of our Christian colleges are peopled by professors and students who are in one way or another embracing open theism. Again, a logically impeccable ramification of the typical Christian worldview, I would argue. And less interested in what the Bible actually teaches. It's more interested in being consistent. And within the perspective of open theism, what's the view of God? God is an incredibly nice guy who feels our pain and identifies with our suffering and our pain and would love to do something about it if only he could. And the importance is on his love and his relationship to us at the expense of him having any sovereignty or power or ability to actually do anything about it. See, so God is limited because sin is sin. Evil is evil. The destruction it brings in the world, I mean, what's he going to do about it? All he can do is fix it, but he can't stop it from being there because that comes out of the corruption of the world and the freedom of human beings and so on. It's not unusual in Christian circles to worry that maybe God is going to be overwhelmed by his creation. I was watching TV the other day, a guy responding to the possibility that God could be behind Tim Tebow's success by dismissing that because he's got better things to do. God's got better things to do. But that perspective that God might be limited by the size and scope of the task of running the universe, you know, that makes sense if he's the equal to the universe. It may just be big enough and overwhelming enough that he's going to have to do that with great difficulty, but not if the universe is that which lives in God and moves in God and has its being in God, then that makes no sense. And the fact that God can in any way be influenced by his creation, probably the most important and popular and universal expression of this is our attitude toward prayer. That it is commonplace in Christianity to think in terms of prayer actually changing the way history goes. Through my prayer, I can steer history and steer God's governance of history, as if my prayer could influence him. Again, think in terms of the analogy. If I, as a novelist, have one of my characters appeal to me, is it conceivable? Jack, would you please do this? Hey, that's a great idea. I didn't think about that. It's not going to work that way. Any prayer that I would pray is going to be put in my mouth by the creator of my being, right? So prayer is not there to actually change the way history goes and change what God does in his governments and history. It's playing an entirely different role, and that's not it. The view of prayer that we have in Christendom is a pagan conception of prayer, where the pagan uses incantations and frog legs and witches' brews and that kind of stuff to influence the powers that be that do indeed dwell in this cosmos, are the powers that are infused within this cosmos. And if I can bring my devices to bear on them and change the way they operate, then I can change the outcome of my life. That makes sense in paganism. It makes no sense in a biblical worldview. And yet, we readily embrace that concept of prayer as much as it makes no sense within what I think is a biblical worldview. But I think the reason is because the typical Christian does not have the biblical worldview about who God is in his relationship to the creation. He has a pagan view of God's relationship to the creation. Okay, let me pause there for any comments or questions.
I have a couple areas where I'm not quite with you here. I think I'll just take one.
Okay.
And the last point you made is kind of a good example. Let's take your model as the framework in which we talk about this. My understanding of the model as you've spelled it out is that the accounts of God acting in history are, in essence, God the author writing himself into the story. So when we look at, you know, Abraham negotiating with the angel or something like that, or let's take my prayer to be saved. I mean, I hear the gospel and I say, yes, you know, Jesus says, you know, knock and it shall be open to you. And I think the corollary is don't knock and it won't be open to you. So in terms of history, God acts. If I knock, the door opens, and if I don't knock, it doesn't open. So you can describe it in two different ways, right? I mean, you can say that God, the transcendent author of things, there's nothing that happened in this story that he hadn't already worked out. And if I knock, it's because he had worked out in the story that I was going to knock. And if I don't knock, it's because he had worked out that I wasn't going to knock. But for me, in the story, I can't say to myself, the author's already worked it out. So, I mean, then there wouldn't be any point in doing anything. I mean, I wouldn't knock at the door because I said, well, you know, that's already worked itself out. So it seems to me the way God enters into his creation, that on that level, that he does respond. That is, it makes a difference. You ask him to save you and he does, or you say, go away, and he does. So I don't, and several of the...
That's true.
Okay,
that's
so true. And so I guess I'm not following several of the points that you've made there about the problematic things that Christians do. I feel like, in one sense, I mean, the Bible talks in those terms. I mean, I feel like I could see the Bible saying that God responds and is affected and all that kind of stuff. It just depends on what level you're talking about. So I don't see how I can either say to myself that I shouldn't see prayer as changing things, because any petitionary prayer that God promises to answer yes if you ask, of course it's going to change things. I mean, if right?
But do you think when you see that bumper sticker on those cars, prayer changes things, do they mean the same thing by that you do?
Well, yeah, but I would say that I and they have a different perspective on things, but that's not the place where the problem is. That is, I could easily believe in God who wrote a story that was essentially, in this story, nothing happens unless somebody asks me, the author, to do it. And every time they ask, if they have enough faith and belief that it will happen, it will happen. He could have written a story like that, in which case their bumper sticker, I mean, your model of God's sovereignty could be true, and their bumper sticker could be true. Right? I mean, you see what I'm saying? If God had written a story where prayer changes things, then, I mean, in the way, like, I could say right now, folks, if we all believe enough, we can raise the pews up in the air. Let's believe really hard, and in the story that God's writing, when we pray and believe really hard that the pews will rise up in the air, in that story, they do. I mean, he could have written a story like that. He would still be sovereign. He would still have worked it out from beginning to end. My problem with the bumper sticker prayer changes things is within the story that God wrote, I think it's putting too much emphasis on what prayer can accomplish. It can accomplish certain things, but not that.
Okay, but My contention would be you're going to look long and far for a Christian who emphasizes that prayer changes things, who doesn't have the perspective that if you look at history, I mean, let's take something pretty big. American culture is coming to a crisis. if we Christians just all get together and pray sincerely every day, all day long for the next year, we're going to save this country and turn it around. I mean, is that not unusual to hear that? Well, I think your perspective, Ron, would be not if that's not in the cards as far as God is concerned. Not if that's not where God has intended to take history. I mean, I absolutely agree with your theoretical possibility. If God were writing a story where he only had things happen in the story that had been asked by the characters, yes, God could do that. I don't think that's the reality we live in, but God could have done that. But that's not the worldview that the typical Christian has. The typical Christian has the worldview that God doesn't really kind of exactly know where history is going to go, and we are going to determine where it's going to go by our obedience, by our cooperation, through prayer, through intercession, all getting together and having enough of us lobby God so that it makes a difference. I mean, that's the way I experience Christian culture. I think that's what they're saying.
I'll just end by saying, I don't know if we're connecting on the point here. I'm still left with, I don't know how to take that last thing that you were saying. I mean, because I can write my own bumper sticker that says prayer changes things, and I think it's true. And I think you would think it's true too. God hasn't set things up so that we can get together, form a majority, and say and convince him that he's going to do that. The way he's written the story, it's more like the analogy of a father. A kid comes and says, can I have this? And the father says, in this case, I know better than you, so no. I mean, and I can't do anything to change his mind. But sometimes he says yes. So in that sense, the manifestation of God in this creation responds to me with either yes, I will save you as you ask, I've promised to do so, or no, I'm not going to save America because it's time for America to go down, and I can see why you would want that, but I'm not going to.
Right.
But that's not related to the sovereignty of God. I mean, God sovereignly wrote all of that, but sometimes he's responding to what I'm saying and sometimes not.
Okay. What I'm proposing is that you don't have a prayer changes thing bumper sticker on your car, and I think there's a reason for that. It's kind of not really the point. Right? I mean, it's not front and center of your worldview. As much as yes, there's a sense in which you could. It's not like you deny that prayer changes things. I don't deny that prayer changes things in the right kind of sense. But it's so qualified that it's not likely to make it onto the bumper sticker on my car. Why are there people out there who have it on their bumper sticker? My contention is you'll find a one-to-one correspondence between that attitude toward prayer and a worldview that doesn't even begin to understand God as so completely transcendent that the whole thing is scripted by him. I'd be willing to bet you that they don't have that worldview. And that's what I'm talking about. You're right. You could have a view of prayer that is consistent with the sovereignty of God, that would include the proposition prayer changes things, but that's kind of beside the point. That's not why the Christians in Christendom emphasize that the way they do. They're beginning from a worldview that is not the right view of God, is what I'm contending. And I think if we did an empirical study, we'd see a correlation between their attitude toward prayer and their view of God's relationship to creation.
Similar question. In the Old Testament, and I don't remember exactly where, I think maybe with Jonah and Nineveh, and maybe Moses pleading for the people, I'm not sure, it says that God changed his mind and mm-hmm. repented of the evil that he was going to do. How does that fit with your...
Okay. Ron hinted at it, that we really have to think about God in two distinctive ways. On the one hand, he's the transcendent author of literally everything. But when he comes into the world and reveals himself to mankind, and in this case to Israel in the Old Testament, when he comes and reveals himself to Israel, notice that he reveals himself as a character. He's a god to Israel, not completely unlike the way Marduk is a god in Babylon and Re as a god in Egypt, that he takes on a more limited role. I mean, where I really began to see the importance of making this distinction is, notice when God gives the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not murder. And I remember somebody asking me once, well, if you're right, if divine determinism is right, and he didn't want him to murder, why doesn't he just make him not murder? Why give him a commandment, right? And that's a good question. Why is God giving any commandments? That's not the transcendent author commanding them not to murder. That's the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, who is revealing himself to them in history as their protector, their blesser, the one who will bless them, the one who will protect them, the one who will be their God, and they will be his people. It really is a role that he is creating for himself. So that's not the transcendent God as such speaking. That's Yahweh, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, speaking.
So he could change his mind.
And in a story. In a sense, he could change his mind. Now, even there, we have to nuance that a little bit. Take Moses, for example, where God is basically negotiating with Moses. Moses, I'm so fed up with this people. How about if I destroy every last one of them, and I just start over with you, Moses? And Moses says, I think I read your promises. I think I understood the purposes that you said you were going to accomplish in history, and that wasn't it. That's not what you promised to do. And then God says, oh, yeah. Yeah, right. I guess I'm stuck with them, aren't I? So we won't do that. Well, really? The God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, even in his role as the one who's promised what he's promised, Moses is not affecting him. Moses is not changing his mind. God has come down and what do we call it? Has done some role-playing with Moses. And why would he engage in role-playing? The reason he would engage in role-playing is so Moses can get in touch with what he, Moses, believes. Oh, no. As much as it would be nice to be the father of a great nation, but that wouldn't make you a great God. And I want you to be a great God more than I want me to be the father of a great nation. So why don't we stick to plan A? That's more important to me. What a huge expression of incredible belief in the God of his fathers and in his promises and in his purposes. That's God eliciting that faith out of Moses.
So that's probably what prayer is all about for us too, the same
exactly.
kind of thing.
Exactly.
So we're not really changing God's right. mind. We're just, he's using that to bring us to where we need to be.
Yeah, I mean, how many times have you begun to pray for what you really intensely want, and the minute you begin to verbalize it, you begin to realize, but maybe not. Maybe that's not really the good thing. Maybe that's not the best thing. Is that really what I want? Or do I actually want your will to be done? And it's in the arena of prayer very often, that's the crucible in which you and I actually gain clarity about what we want. Certainly what we should want. I mean, we can go into it intellectually knowing what we should want, and then as we imagine ourselves in the very presence of God speaking our mind about what I want, all of a sudden what I should want begins to loom larger. Okay, now what I really want is for your will to be done, not my will to be done. So I think prayer is an incredibly important phenomenon in human experience. Because at its essence and at its best, I mean, I think prayer is not just one thing. I mean, there's lots of different aspects to it. But at the essence of what prayer is, it's a one-to-one personal encounter with my Creator, where I am wrestling with the nature of my own desires and resolving them into faith, if there's faith there to resolve them into.
So then these places where God really asks us to pray, which, like, there's one in Chronicles, where he says, if my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray, then I will heal their land. So rather than it being a command to pray so that I will do something, it's more of a command to pray so that you will change. I mean, not that people will change, not that God will change. I mean, he seems to ask us in many places to pray.
Okay, let's in a passage like that, don't you think the humility is the operative commandment there rather than prayer? See, we reverse it because we're so accustomed to this other perspective that, I mean, why did I become a Christian if it wasn't to help God change the world? And prayer is the tool that he gave me to change the, I mean, I don't know what we're thinking, but something like that. So we automatically go to the prayer there instead of the humble yourself part. To pray, you don't have to humble yourself. Right. But the critical thing is that you humble yourselves. And what is prayer then? It's an expression of your smallness and God's largeness. Right? I mean, that's why he says pray. Recognize who's in control. Recognize who your God is. Since I'm God, since I'm the one who can deliver, since I'm the one in control, know that, acknowledge that, and trust me, you know, rely upon me. So I don't think it's a commandment to a religious discipline or even a religious act. It's a commandment to a certain heart orientation. Know that I am God, and know that you are my people and my creature. Does that make sense?
I think I was getting a little lost there. Now, are you saying the story is equivalent to God, or it's God is one level, you know, a level way above that. What
God is it? Above, okay. Is a level above the reality that we live in. Yeah.
Okay. And then, let's see, was like worship? Was that like, or did you say there wasn't a feedback, or was like worship the design feedback in the story?
I don't think it's helpful or meaningful to think of what we do feeding back on God and benefiting him.
Okay.
Now, I can qualify that, but okay. Go ahead. Go ahead with your question.
Well, go ahead and qualify it. Maybe that'll take care of it.
Now, is God benefiting from creation? Yeah, I think so. He's benefiting from the product of his creative act, but he's not benefiting from the elements of what he's created. That's the distinction I would make. Why did God create anything at all? We'll talk about this more coming up, but he created, I think, in order to give expression to who he is, to objectify in something other than him who he is. I think it's not unlike the way artists talk about the music they write or the painting that they paint or the drawing that they draw being an act of self-expression. Why would you describe it as an act of self-expression? Because I'm conceiving of the work of my aesthetic works as somehow taking something of my values, taking something of what I'm committed to, taking something of who I am, and objectifying it into something other than me. And that objectification of who I am, that gives expression to who I am, I think that's why God created the world. We are the work of his hands, the work of his mind, because he's taking from who he is and objectifying it in something else. Not giving birth to it like a child. It's not really of his substance. It's of an entirely alien substance. But it has the meaning and significance of reflecting who he is. You don't need an audience for that. See, the thing that really drives me crazy is when people talk about how they answer difficult philosophical questions by saying, he did this so that the angels would see, or that so we human beings would see. That's like saying a novelist made the story go this way so that his characters would see something or other. Well, he could have solved that problem by not having any characters. That who didn't need to know it, or by creating them already knowing that. I mean, there are other ways to do that. but the story is written so that God can see himself reflected in what it is that he has created. He need be the only spectator to his work. There doesn't have to be anyone else.
Yeah, it seemed to me that since he instructs us various places to worship him, that would be like a design feedback. Maybe he does get something out of it, but that might be beyond us.
Can you think of any place in the Bible that says that that's why we worship?
Well, why we worship?
Mm-hmm. That's the reason he wants us to worship?
No, I just think of a few areas where it says, worship him or like worship Jesus. So, and then the Jewish people, their all lives are built around, worshiping God.
Right, right.
So it seemed like that was like, a design feedback, as you would call it.
Okay, but this is a crucial point, mm-hmm. critical point, Tim. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Notice, though, that last step is you're supplying that. You're not deriving that from what the Bible teaches. You're actually interjecting that. You're asking yourself the question, well, why would he want that kind of worship? I have an answer. But that answer is coming from your philosophical assumptions and your worldview, your culture, what you've been taught to think, and so on and so forth. That's not actually being directly derived from the Bible itself. So the possibility exists, maybe I need to answer that question from a different worldview, from a different set of values, from a different perspective. But my immediate answer that I give to questions like that out of my own philosophical worldview seems so natural because it's what I've always believed. And that's what this whole series is, that's what I'm trying to do, is to say, but maybe we need to pause and wait and think about this for a second. Maybe there are other answers, and indeed maybe there are better answers than the ones I've always given to questions like that.
Also on prayer, let's see, I think you covered about, people, asking for things, asking, to possibly change things, like someone's sick, could you, make him well, whatever. That there's more to prayer. There's also the praising, when you pray,
right.
Thanking God for things and praising him for various things.
Okay, there's a great example. Why is it good that we offer up praise to God in prayer? Because God needs praise, or because we need to be praising? You see the difference? Is it because God somehow needs our praise, the praise of his own creation? I don't think so. I think it's because we need to be the kind of creatures who acknowledge the worth of our Creator. Because if we are not the kind of creatures who acknowledge the worth of our Creator, then we're not the kind of creatures we ought to be. We're reprobate.
Well, I don't know if God actually needs our praise, but does he want our praise?
Well, yes, he wants it, but does he want it for his sake, or does he want it for our sake?
And
you see the difference?
Yes. And I don't think we can actually know that for sure.
Well, I think we can. If we, granted, you're not going to be able to find an essay in the Bible that discusses that and gives us the biblical answer to it. But I think if we live in the Bible and try to reconstruct its worldview from dwelling in the biblical literature, I think sooner or later we're going to be able to choose between those two answers. But if we're too facile, if we're just, just immediately give a quick answer, we're going to give the answer that we've been taught. We're going to give the answer that we're comfortable with. We're going to give the answer that we're familiar with. And that's what I'm saying. Let's not be facile here. Let's stop, pause, think about this, and put all the information of the Bible together to construct that worldview that makes the biblical literature coherent, answers all of our questions in one account, instead of this fragmented patchwork of when asked this question, answer this way. When asked this other question, answer this other way. When asked this question, answer this way. That's what we are taught. Yeah.
Let's see. Okay, open theism. I don't know if we've heard that term before. Could you say some more about it?
Open theism is the view that the traditional view of God that he is, that he knows the future, is false. God cannot know the future. And he has only a limited capacity to control his sovereignty over reality. He can't control, for example, the free choices of human beings. So God's doing the best he can with this mess that we have created. And he doesn't know what's going to happen, but he means well.
Okay, that answers it. Thanks.
It's very seductive to Christians today because it really is way more consistent with the Christian worldview, and I'm distinguishing the Christian worldview from the biblical worldview. It's way more consistent, I think, with the Christian worldview than most of what Christians say. And so it's seductive because it's a very rational and logical playing out of the implications of what most Christians believe. And I think the only real antidote to it is a whole different worldview, the biblical worldview. I don't think you can beat it from inside the Christian worldview.
Oftentimes I hear and it's usually an attempt to negate the importance of the Jewish monotheism, but that the Jews slowly came to understand that God was the monotheistic being whom we view him as today. He went from being the God among gods to being the Most High God to being the only God they have to do with to finding out that, well, he's the only God, period. I'm sure there's great scholarship on that somewhere. But in listening to these questions and listening to your answers, it seems to me that the first part of the Bible reveals God as the all-powerful creator. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth and everything and everyone in it. Boom. Period. And that's it. There's no backstory to him. You know, there's no great bodies of dragons being cut up and made into parts of the universe or him being born from another god. It starts out, this is who God is. He's the guy who said, let there be light. And then as he goes along, it seems to me that with Moses, he says, tell them that I am he who is. And he separates himself from any god that needs the earth to express himself or have a place to live or to wield power. And so, and that's enormous. I mean, that's the demarcation from the Egyptian gods is so obvious, and the gulf between him and them is, I think, uncrossable, really. And then, he has these conversations. And you would say that the God who is there is the God who is all-powerful. He is the author of all reality, moment to moment. And yet when he interacts with his creation, he throws his voice into that creation to have that interaction. And you almost seem to be saying that he uses another voice, like a ventriloquist does, that when he's using his throne voice, he sort of presents him.
Huh? His what voice did you say?
When he uses his throne voice, his ventriloquist voice.
Oh, throne, yeah.
He sort of presents himself a little different at times. And that's how he can have the arguments, and that's how he can ask the questions. He sort of presents himself as just God, not like God in big capital letters that won't fit in reality,
right.
But I'm just God,
right?
For your sake,
I'm your God,
yeah,
and I want you to be my people.
And
yeah.
I think that that's a little confusing.
It is confusing, but is it any more confusing than the alternative of the sovereign transcendent God coming along to his characters and saying, "Okay, now listen up. Shape up. I want you to do this and not that. Okay? You got it? I'm counting on you guys. I'm counting on you doing it the way I say to do it." I see the conflict, the tension there?
Absolutely, okay. But it seems to me that if the model we have and what we think we're seeing is true, it would have been really cool if one of the Old Testament writers had spotted that and made it more glaringly obvious, like in the book of Ecclesiastes, if that had been a play instead of a book of wisdom. If he just, well, here's a play that explains our place before God. He's really not here, but he can affect here, so it appears as if he's here.
My problem is I'm a New Testament student, and I'm ignorant of the Old Testament. I wouldn't be surprised if it's there. I just don't know where. But it wouldn't surprise me at all if we were hip enough to what's going on there that we wouldn't see the right kind of examination of that.
Well, I think we have. That's why you have the model you have.
Well,
now, if you start out with that model and say, I've read through the Bible, and I've come back, and I've come up with this model, and I'm going to lay it over the Revelation and go, does it hang together? Is it a possible explanation?
Right.
I think it is.
Right. In my notes, what I eventually go on to suggest is, how do I choose between these models? Why do I embrace the author model and not these others? Because if the author model is right, then I can explain the reason that the Bible says that we have freedom, and yet God determines everything at the same time, without embarrassment, without contradiction. Both freedom and sovereignty coexist and can be reconciled. The author model can reconcile that. None of the other models can reconcile that. Foreknowledge, I had a list of things there I'd have to remind myself, but the way in which what the Bible does teach us is explainable in terms of the author model in a way that's coherent, rational, you know, philosophically tenable. The other models cannot do that. So it's the, if you will, the fruitfulness of the author model for being able to explain everything else that we read and encounter in the Bible that would be my argument for why that's got to be it. That must be what the apostles and the prophets and the biblical writers everywhere are assuming, because otherwise they're blithering idiots. And I don't think they're blithering idiots. So it's abductive reasoning that I introduced when I was talking about Ehrman. Here's the bloody glove, here's the footprint, here's the fingerprint, here's the broken glass. I can give you an account that explains all of those. You got a better account? That's the argument that the prosecutor makes. My argument is I see unmistakably the compatibility of freedom and sovereignty in the Bible. I see these other elements in the biblical literature. I can give you an account that can explain all of those. It's that God is a transcendent author of all reality, and it's in him that we live and move and have our being. If we posit that, all of those things make sense. You got a better explanation? I can't come up with one. I can't come up with any other better way to understand the Creator and his relationship to the creation than as the transcendent cause and origin of all that exists.
Hi, Jack. I've heard you talk about this model many times before, and every time you emphasize something a little bit different. This time, I'm wondering if you're saying something new than what I've heard you say before, or if you're...
I'm sorry, sir.
I'm wondering if you're saying something new, different than what you've said before, from what I've heard you say before, or if you're just emphasizing something different. And so I'm going to ask a few questions just to figure out. The way that you put the author model and talking about, you gave different scenarios with prayer and worship, how it's not as though God needs that. It'd be like thinking that the author is deriving some benefit from his characters doing this. It sort of sounds like the problem with that, that I have with that, is that it makes God seem removed from what his characters are doing. And not just in a way that he doesn't need them, but in a way that what they that he's not involved in that story at all, in a sense. And I think from other things you've said before that that's not true. You don't actually think that God isn't involved. But maybe you should comment on that.
Okay, first of all, the emphasis on all that stuff is an answer to an objection. The objection would be, no, Christians out there in Christendom, in typical Christian land, don't believe the God that you say they believe in. And I'm saying, yes, they do. That all these things are fingers pointing to the fact that they really actually have a different conception of God. They worship a different God than the God of the Bible, I mean, to put it boldly. And the God that they worship is a God who's more the equal of his creation, not the transcendent author of the creation. And I was only emphasizing those things to try to make the point that I really do think we have a different God, and we have to make up our minds which God are we going to believe in, which God are we going to worship. Now, the problem, the immediate problem with the author model is it does seem to make God above it all, right? But what I would contend is, let's say like that God was like most novelists today, who doesn't involve himself in the novel at all. Most novelists are completely invisible in the reality that they create in a novel they write. They're not talking lamps that talk to the characters from the lamp and, you know, all kinds of stuff that they could do, but they don't do that. They just remain completely behind the scenes. God could have done that. He didn't have to reveal himself in history. He didn't have to reveal himself to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and so on and so forth. He could have just run history, and history would have gone however history was going to go, scripted by God. In fact, he did interject himself into history, take on roles himself, and interact with us as one more character within the story. But let's say that he didn't, just for the sake of argument. Does that make him removed? And my contention would be, no, it doesn't make him removed at all. In fact, I would argue it makes him closer. Take the traditional attribute of God in systematic theology, his omnipresence. Every child has had a problem with the omnipresence of God. It makes no sense. If God is a God who inhabits space like we do, okay, he's really big and he inhabits all space. Well, if you say so. But I'm not sure we even really believe that. We know we're supposed to believe it, so we espouse it. But really, can we believe that God occupies all space? I don't think so. But the advantage, of course, of God's omnipresence is it makes him proximate. He's close. He's near at hand. He's right here with me. But in the author model, you can't get more close at hand, more intimate, more connected with every human being and every little sparrow, for that matter, than the author of all of reality, carefully focused on crafting every detail of the story of your life. If that's not intimacy, I don't know what is. Now, he's not a human author, so by focusing on you, he hasn't forsaken me and neglected me. So, I mean, what he's capable of doing that a human author is not capable of doing is be simultaneously focused, intent. What's the word I'm looking for? Can't get it. Engaged. Thank you. Fully engaged in making in creating your story to be an expression of his character, of his values, and so on, from beginning to end. Nothing is random. There is no noise. Nothing is out of his control. It's all carefully designed to create your story to be your story. He's intimately concerned about you. Way more intimate. That's way more intimate than he even could possibly be under the other model. So, where at first blush it may seem like it removes him, I don't think it removes him. It brings him infinitely close. He can't be closer to my life than he actually is.
And that's something that I have heard you kind of say before, and I think good to hear in the context of the other things that you were saying, because it's, you do have that problem when you start emphasizing the sovereignty of God, that kind of getting away from his unique involvement in this story that he's creating and this creation that he's made. So what you have, I think, in the Bible is a picture of a transcendent God who is intimately concerned with his creation and yet completely in control of it.
Right.
And there's that tension in that, I think as humans, we always want to make it more about us and have it, have God be someone who we're influencing because that makes us more important.
That's right.
And I think that's really what you're, getting at. Not so much trying to make a new picture of God that makes him untouchable.
Just. Right. Yeah. Even though in a sense he is, but I want to push him away so that he can get close. So that he can be close, not have him be up in the heavens, but have him be in every second and every nanosecond of my life. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not a matter of what I want. I mean, I just think that's the biblical picture. But the reality is, it's not a paradigm that makes him remote and abstract and irrelevant and beyond it all. He's so beyond it all that he's right here.
And the more that I've thought about your analogy, the more it seems to me that what it really matters for, to know that God is the author, is to know that the end of the story is not random.
Right.
Not so much that it doesn't really have any bearing on what I do right now, but just on how I perceive kind of my attitude toward where I am at right now and what God is going to do.
Right, so. Exactly. Okay, I'm going to have to let you go. That's too much philosophy for anybody for one day. So. Let's pray. God, as the author of our being, as the one looking into every nook and cranny of our lives to shape it and mold it and design it and purpose it in order that your story might be told, your unique story in our individual lives might be told, We just ask that you would open our eyes that we might know you and acknowledge you and see you and therefore love you, and that might be the driving purpose of our very existence. In Jesus' name, amen.